It's encouraging to see that there are fewer people hospitalized for COVID illness during this surge, especially compared with prior surges. But I do want to note that even if folks aren't in there getting care for COVID-related illness, COVID-positive patients represent a substantial strain on the healthcare system when so many of our hospitals are, as we've noted earlier, short on staff.
LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer last week talking about the massive surge in COVID cases we're seeing tied to the Omicron variant. County health officials recorded 45,000 new cases yesterday, and that's a new record. This massive, rapid nationwide spike is causing staffing problems at hospitals, schools, and other essential businesses. It's so severe that California health officials even changed the state's COVID quarantine protocols, allowing healthcare workers who test positive for the disease but are asymptomatic to return to work. Some of the nation's top epidemiologists say this super wave shows that COVID is probably here to stay and that the Biden administration's promise to end the pandemic is no longer the best approach. Dr. Michael Osterholm is one of them. He's head of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota and a former advisor to President Biden's pandemic response, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, why do you think COVID is basically here to stay?
Well, we knew that really from the very earliest days of its emergence in humans. As like so many other viral pathogens like this, HIV, influenza viruses, et cetera, once they're established in humans, it's very difficult to imagine how you ever get them out, particularly when you have a situation where you don't have of the kind of protection that you get from long antibodies and your immune system. So in this case, unlike smallpox, where you can vaccinate and get protection for a lifetime, we don't have that with this virus. So we never thought that we were not going to deal with it. I think the challenge is, and what you were alluding to here, will we always be in a pandemic state, this idea of a global outbreak? And I think that's the point we're talking about, is how do we get to the new normal, where we begin to live with this virus, and we live with it in a very different way than we have the last 2 years.
Well, when do you think that will happen? Or do you think that that is something we need to start doing now?
Well, I think it will happen over the course of the next year for several reasons. First is, we have to understand that we could very well have another variant like Omicron emerge 6 months from now. Could even be more infectious than Omicron. It could actually evade immune protection from our current vaccines and from having been previously infected. But the point being is that we can get better technologies in our vaccines. And we're already looking at that. How could we get vaccines that might actually protect against a number of variants by going for parts of the virus that actually are stable, that don't change between variants or are unlikely to change? The second thing is, don't forget that just, you know, not that all long ago, being HIV infected was a death sentence. In the 80s into the early 90s, it was a horrible, horrible diagnosis. Today, we've made it more into a chronic manageable disease in many parts of the world because of drug therapies. We don't have a vaccine for HIV, but we have incredible drug therapies. We're going to see the same thing unfold over the course of the next 6 to 12 months with drugs for COVID. And I think these drugs are going to be quite effective if given very early in the infection. They will keep you from getting seriously ill or being hospitalized. And together with vaccines that could be more protective, I think we really have the opportunity to change the way COVID looks like throughout the world. And in that regard, I think that, again, the next year will be a very important part of that. So we will get rid of the pandemic as we know it, but we will still be living with COVID.
And so living with COVID, does that mean that we regularly get, I don't know, 3-4 vaccines a year?
No, at this point, we're never going to be able to do that. Not just in our country, but clearly for the world, we won't be able to do it. And it's going to be a matter of, if we get better vaccines, which I think we will, that may have longer protection, that are more specific protection against different variants. But again, this is going to be in combination with that of the drugs. Now, remember, we already do provide annual flu shots, and that's something that we accept in high-income countries. Now, the challenge is most of the low- and middle-income countries don't have access to annual influenza vaccines. So we need to really rethink, even if we are going to use vaccines as often as once a year, how will we do that? I'm not saying that that's what will eventually be the case, but we have to be prepared for that. And our hope is, however, that we'll get better vaccines that can give us more long-term protection against a wider variety of potential variants that could emerge from this one or any other new COVID, coronavirus that emerges. Remember, we've had SARS, we've had MERS, now we have COVID. What's the next one to emerge that isn't this one? And that's what we're really up against right now, trying to make sure that we have better vaccines for that.
Now, you have said that we are not at the beginning of the end, but rather the end of the beginning when it comes to this pandemic. In the next few weeks or so, what are you anticipating?
Well, I said almost 5 weeks ago, and now I'm going close to 6 weeks ago, that we would be in a viral blizzard for the next, 6 to 10 weeks. And that's where we're at right now. We're in a viral blizzard. The entire country is really getting hit with this virus, Omicron. Remember, when we look at past surges with the COVID virus, you can see locations in this country that were heavily, heavily hit, where other areas were largely spared. When we look at the Delta variant and how it really hit hard in the southern Sunbelt states last summer and then took off across much of the northern part of the country in late summer, early fall, and persisted for some months there. Meanwhile, LA and New York were basically in pretty darn good shape. And people would say, ha ha, see, we're over it. We have enough people vaccinated. We have had enough people who've been infected. And of course, our response was, no, that's not the case. So we had these regional geographic kind of rolling surges that occurred. What makes Omicron so different is it's hitting all at once, all around the country. And the attack rates or the percentage of people who are getting infected is exceedingly high. It is at least 10% virtually everywhere. And I think we're going to see by the time this surge of the next 3 to 4 weeks is over, we're going to see anywhere from 20 to 40% of the entire population will have been infected.
Wow. So in the next 3 to 4 weeks, what do you recommend when it comes to schools, for example? Should they go back to remote learning or not?
We all want kids to be in school. There's all kinds of reasons why. But let's first of all be clear. We got to stop saying schools are safe. Safe is a relative term implying no risk. We know today that the early days of the COVID pandemic gave us information supporting that kids rarely got infected in schools. We saw that change with Alpha, the first variant last spring. We saw it change even more with Delta, and we're clearly seeing it with Omicron. We have a number of school-based outbreaks already in the country just in the last 3 weeks that have occurred with Omicron. So it's not you can say the schools are perfectly safe. But having said that, it's not safe to be at home either. Kids are going to get infected wherever they're at. And so one of the things we want to do is try to limit that. But let's be a realist, okay, and realize that if kids are out playing or in contact with friends, neighbors, we're seeing that now. What I think is the major determining factor of whether schools can be open, stay open, do they have teachers? Do they have staff members? Do they have bus drivers? Right now, we're seeing major challenges in school districts around the country with that. Schools reporting 25 to 40% absenteeism among its faculty and staff. Well, that's not a safe way to run a school. If you're going to have that many people out sick, can you actually have kids in school? So, my whole message has continued to be basically the next 3 to 4 weeks are going to be a challenge. This is not the next 3 to 4 months. This is not the next year. It's not like the previous 2 years. We've got to get through this viral blizzard. And if you live in Minnesota, at least you know that, within days after a blizzard, you typically get a snowmelt. Everything opens back up again. That's what I think is going to happen here. So for the sake of our kids, I would really urge parents and faculty and politicians just to take a step back and say, we just got to get through the next 3 to 4 weeks. And again, when I hear parents say to me, well, but I got to have my kids in school because I have to work. That is absolutely a critical point. But the problem is if your kids are home sick for a week, or longer, you're going to be home anyway. The challenge is, how do we get through these next 3 to 4 weeks?
Exactly. And so some people say, I don't know, it feels like it's everywhere. I'm just going to get it. Even if I'm boosted or even if I've had 3, maybe 4 vaccines at this point. Is that a reasonable response just to kind of throw your hands up and say, I'm just going to get it?
Well, we're human, so I guess it would have to say that's a reasonable response. Humans do that. But having said that, I'm not going to get it. I'm doing everything I can to distance myself and be protected, to bubble. And I would hope more people would do that, because as you heard from the lead-in on this very interview, the interview you did with the local health department person emphasized just what was happening to the local healthcare systems. We're seeing our healthcare systems in this country stretched unlike any time in modern history. They're not just bending anymore, they're breaking because of the increased patient load that's coming with COVID. And now on top of it, 20, 30% of healthcare workers are off infected themselves. Even though they're fully vaccinated, we have had a lot of breakthrough infections. And that's still good news in the sense that very few of these go on and develop any kind of severe illness or need for hospitalization. The vaccines are working, but they're not keeping you from getting infected necessarily. So, you know, we don't want to strain the healthcare system any more than possible. It's a challenge. This is not just for those with COVID. It's for people who have heart attacks, people who have strokes, people who are in automobile accidents. Right now, the healthcare systems are in trouble. So hopefully we can get through these next 3 to 4 weeks. And we can limit the number of people who get infected, who have to go into the hospital and be part of that really challenging situation.
Wanoa, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. That's Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, also a former advisor to President Biden's pandemic response. The Legal Eagle will be here to talk about the federal civil rights trial against the man convicted of killing Ahmaud Arbery. Jessica Levinson is here next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. On Friday, the three men convicted of murdering Ahmaud Arbery received sentences of life in prison, two of them without the possibility of parole. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, told the judge the men were fully committed to their crimes and they should be fully committed to the consequences.
They chose to target my son because they didn't want him in their community. They chose to treat him differently than other people who frequently visited their community. And when they couldn't sufficiently scare him or intimidate him, they killed him.
Those three men who chased and killed Arbery while he was jogging through a Georgia neighborhood now face a second trial, this time on federal hate crime charges. And here to look ahead to next month's trial is Loyola Law School Professor Jessica Levinson, a regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
So these men will likely spend the rest of their lives in prison. Only one of them is eligible for parole, and that's after 30 years, and he's not a young man. They can't be punished more than they already have. So what is the purpose of having this other trial?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I think for a couple of reasons. One is that the judgment in the state case where they did find, in fact, that McMichaels and Brian committed these murders, that it's not final yet, that it's still going through the appeals process. Once the appeals are over, then the judgment is really final. And then it becomes a question of federal resources, whether or not they want to move forward. But I think the other thing is not just because the appeals will still be ongoing, but to hold people accountable, to say, we know that you're going to be incarcerated, but we also think that you did this, and we need a full and fair airing on these issues. So I think it's really those two things.
And what will federal prosecutors try to prove here? Because it's not a murder trial.
Exactly. It's not a murder trial. They're going to try and prove that McMichaels and Brian acted with a racist intent that, and I'm going to quote from the statute for a second, that they willfully by force and threat of force injured, intimidated, or interfered with Arbery's ability to use a public street because of his race. And again, that's what this federal crime, that's what this federal trial is all about. Did they act because of Arbery's race? And we've seen the federal government be a little bit more aggressive with these hate crimes charges, but that's why this is different. It's not whether or not they had malice when they killed Arbery. It's what was their, what was one of their motivating factors here in their treatment of him.
And that was not in the state trial, that part of it?
It was not in the state trial, even though an investigator had uncovered evidence that the friend Brian had told the investigator that McMichaels used a horrible racial slur during that incident. And I think the prosecutors made a tactical decision to simplify that case, to have it just be about whether or not they were guilty of murder and not bring in the issues of whether or not they were motivated by race explicitly, in the sense that they didn't want to muddy the waters for the jury, for them to have to think through, was that really said? They wanted to, the way they charged that state crime, really focus on just guilt or innocence based on how the state law was phrased, not bring in other things to streamline it for the jury.
Hmm. Last week, before the sentencing, the Department of Justice approached the Arbery family about a plea deal. And the McMichaels, both father and son, sentenced to life without parole, would receive 30 years in prison if they admitted that Arbery's killing was motivated by hate. And the family rejected that. Let me just play a clip of tape of the family's attorney, Lee Merritt, speaking to CBS This Morning on Friday.
I think it shows that we have a Department of Justice that is aggressively pursuing hate crimes, that is aggressively pursuing accountability in cases where, you know, we haven't seen that before. And so I think they're intimidated by the amount of preparation and the overwhelming amount of evidence that was going against them. And they knew that, you know, this wasn't going to be another normal day in court for them, but that they would be facing severe penalties.
Right. So what do you make of that? That they were willing to seek a plea deal and plead guilty?
I think for the prosecution, you know, offering the plea deal, it's essentially a life sentence. You don't need to risk a trial. Going to trial is always a risk, even if you have a lot of evidence. For the defendants, I think it would make sense because, as we talked about, they probably will spend the rest of their lives incarcerated. For the family, for the victim's family, for Arbery's family, they've said really specifically, we think these federal charges are just as important as the state charges, and we want them to stand trial. They want that public moment. They want the prosecutors to come forward and for all of us to hear what the evidence is and why they think it shows that Brian and McMichaels, in fact, were motivated by hate, by racist hate. And so every group kind of has slightly different motivations and goals here.
Okay, let's switch gears and talk about another legal matter here in Los Angeles. A federal judge ruled against former LA City Councilman Jose Huizar, and he faces a whole bunch of bribery and racketeering charges related to allegations he helped get some real estate projects approved in exchange for some money. First, before we get to the decision, remind us what this case is about.
Well, basically exactly what you said. I mean, this is one of those kind of ripped from the headlines, straight out of a fictional TV type of account where you have allegations that Huizar says to developers, oh, would you like me to assist you in your city approval process? Well, what I would like is campaign donations, private jets to Las Vegas, and money because, as it turns out, I'm facing this sexual harassment suit. Now, of course, I'm paraphrasing here. He didn't specifically say those words, but that's the allegation here, that he ran this rather big pay-to-play scheme and he said, okay, well, there's going to be a price for my help. I'm essentially going to sell my role, my power, my abilities. I'll use that to help you if you do something for me. As it turns out, if that is in fact correct, that is also in fact illegal.
Right. And so Huizar's team said, hey, no, and they wanted most of the counts dismissed. Why?
They wanted most of the counts dismissed for a couple of reasons, but the main reason is they said, okay, if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court case law, then you haven't come forward with enough to show that this amounts to bribery. That basically, because the Supreme Court has narrowed the definition of bribery, and because frankly, they've narrowed the definition or they've made it more difficult in public corruption cases in general, that this doesn't rise to the level that, sure, maybe Huizar picked up the phone, maybe he had campaign donations, but it doesn't fall within that really tight, really specific this for that that the Supreme Court is now requiring here. They also said, look, you've thrown a lot of stuff in here that makes Huizar look bad, but looking, you know, engaging in behavior that we're not necessarily proud of isn't criminal. And they said, you just threw too much in here. You basically threw pasta at the wall to see if it would stick. It reads more like a, you know, a fictional account, or it reads more like a story than it does like particular pieces of evidence that you need to show these crimes.
And the judge did not agree with that, said, no, sorry, you're going to have to face these charges.
Exactly. Or at least you get to move forward with the case. And I think that's part of what the judge's decision here is about, which is this isn't whether or not Huizar is guilty or not guilty. It's not, in fact, even whether they can go to a jury trial. The question is just, have you shown enough in the complaint to be able to move forward to gather more evidence? So if the judge had decided to throw it out at this a very initial stage, it means that the prosecutors can't even go forward trying to continue to gather evidence, et cetera. And so what the judge is really saying here is, okay, you've shown enough that you can keep moving forward.
So given all this, when do you expect a trial?
So the trial is estimated to be in May. And of course, you just did a segment on COVID. You know, scheduling, particularly when it comes to federal courts, can change, but the trial is currently set for May.
Okay. Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the surprise nomination of Aruj Aftab in the Best New Artist category at the Grammys.
There are also millions of people all over the world who listen to alternative music, who listen to this music that I'm making, which really comes out of like 20 years of living in New York and being from Pakistan.
Aruj Aftab is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. When the Grammys announced this year's nominations, the category for Best New Artist included some obvious contenders, such as Olivia Rodrigo, the rapper Sweetie, Phineas, the brother of Billie Eilish. But also nominated is a Brooklyn-based Pakistani artist named Aruj Aftab. That song is from her third album, Vulture Prince, and it was also nominated for Best Global Music Performance at this year's Grammys, making her the first Pakistani woman to be recognized by the Recording Academy. Aftab's lyrics are sung mostly in Urdu, her native language. Her work is inspired by Sufi music, an ancient form of Islamic poetry, and Aruj Aftab joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And congratulations. Were you surprised when you heard the news?
Yeah, very surprised, very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. And you were in Pakistan at the time, I understand, when you heard.
I was, a rare thing, but there I was in Pakistan, yes.
Well, why is it a rare thing? You grew up there and came here when you were, what, 19 years old? Is that right, to study music?
Something like that, yeah. I don't haven't really gone back that much since I came here. I really just sort of hit the ground running when I got here, you know, and really stayed super immersed in music and started building a world of my own.
So you went to the Berklee College of Music, I understand. And had you grown up performing a lot of music as a child?
No, not at all. I think as a child, I was kind of grew up in a household of a lot of music listening, for sure, and music appreciation. And then didn't really start performing until maybe even like my second or third year at Berklee. But of course, like performing as in, you know, kind of playing guitar with friends in high school, or like I had a little garage band in high school too, but nothing really out there.
We have a recording of you singing the Leonard Cohen song, Hallelujah. Can you set that up? How old were you when you sang it and what were the circumstances?
I don't know, maybe 18, 19, maybe younger. I just really loved Leonard Cohen a lot. And then I discovered Jeff Buckley's version. And then I discovered just Jeff Buckley, you know, the Grace album. And like, you know, my mind was blown. Such deep, sad, beautiful, everything that I love, haunting vibes. But yeah, I just really, it was just, you know, it's like your teen angst and everything just kind of gets together and it just all kind of clicked at the same time. And I performed that song in that way. And I guess it just like really reached, it really kind of translated to a lot of people.
Well, let's hear a little bit from your recording of God. Hallelujah.
Why? I sound like a little baby.
Okay, well, let's hear it anyway.
All right, fine. It's not a cry that you hear at night. It's not somebody who's seen the light. It's a call and it's a broken hallelujah. Hallelujah.
It's beautiful. Why don't you like that?
No, I like it. And when it starts playing, then I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, it is good. I mean, the dynamics are so there. I feel like maybe that sort of youth fire, you know, like not afraid of really like belting, and it's very emotive for sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's hear you now, and this is from your latest album, and this song is called Last Night, and it's the only song on the album that is sung in English, and this is a translated poem from the poet, the 13th century poet, Rumi.
So beautiful. So beautiful like the moon. So beautiful like the moon. So beautiful like the moon. Even brighter than the sun. Was even brighter than the sun. Was even brighter than the sun.
So your voice has definitely deepened and matured. That is just beautiful. Talk about how you put this song together, because here you do have the words of a 13th century poet, and then you also have a modern reggae sound in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, Sufi poetry goes with reggae, if you know what I mean, to a certain degree, right?
Well, I don't, so explain.
You know, I feel like some of the ethos of reggae, Rastafarianism, you know, they kind of overlap in their sort of way.
Yeah.
You know, in the kind of romanticization of intoxication and, you know, the substance, the joy, you know, all of those kind of things kind of go together. For me, I've always felt that way. Like, I feel like it's that kind of poetry too that was really kind of resonating with me, like very minimalist, not a lot of words, like comparative to Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah, where it's just there's so much being said, and it's so, you're in a story of lyricism, you know what I mean? Like here it's mm-hmm. just like there's a thought and it's being repeated and you're emoting a lot, but at the same time it's super minimal and there's not a lot really happening. And so I think it's that sort of phase of spaciness and dub, and then Rumi's minimal, like just a few words saying so much kind of vibe that came together for me in that moment and felt right.
That's interesting, because I'm thinking that both lead you to a spiritual plane, both the Leonard Cohen song, of course, Hallelujah, but what you're talking about, the repetition of the same phrase over and over again, can, again, lift you into an altered consciousness. At least that's a thought in many religions, but also Sufism.
Yeah, I think that's one of their core, right? It's like the cycle, the circular motion of the world, and minimalism in general, like less, simpleness, you know, all of that. It's also math, it's also architecture, it's just, you know, it's just like a simpler sort of, it's just really purely minimalism in that sense. It's Sufi poetry for sure, and definitely Rumi's vibe is that way, so...
Hmm. And are you religious? Are you particularly religious in your life?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I grew up with a religion being there by default, right? Like so many of us.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I guess we grew up around it. Like, but yeah, I mean, I try to be a good person, but that's mm-hmm. just inherently impossible, right? Because of the push and pull of the world. It's hard to think about life along those terms or identity, because so much of religion has been such a like basis of so many problems that like just even the word feels like no.
Yeah.
So it's like really just not about that for me.
What is it about for you in these songs?
I think it's about love and the deepness of, you know, I guess just the reality of the world, you know, like how it can fill you with so much disdain for it because of the constant, it's like, it's so relentless in the way that it brings you joy and it brings you so much sadness and it like gives you things and takes things away and you're just kind of in this washing machine cycle. But then without that, everything is pointless, you know what I mean? So kind of just trying to have the most integrity and putting those thoughts and feelings kind of out there into the music. A very personal music is kind of what I've been trying to make, you know.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from your latest album. This one is called Dia Hay.
Dia
is the song Dia Hay by my guest Arooj Aftab, and you're singing in Urdu there. What mm-hmm. what are you saying?
Great pronunciation, by the way. Spot on.
Thank you.
Dia Hay Dil Agar Usko Bashar Hai Kya Kahiye. I'm saying if I give my heart to whoever, what can you really do about it if you give your heart away? That's kind of what I think it says.
And this is a poem by a famous poet in Pakistan named Mirza Ghalib, right? Written in the 19th century.
Yes. He was writing about the sort of exceptional triangle of two, I would say for simplicity, like there's the lover and then there's the beloved and then there's the friend. So it's kind of like a, it's not, you think it'll be a typical love triangle that the friend falls in love with the beloved and the lover, you know, but actually the poem turns towards the friendship between the lover and the friend and is like, well, now that this friend of mine is also in love with my beloved, I have to kind of figure out how to navigate my friendship turning into sort of like a weird animosity situation. So it's really cool for me. I felt that that is, you know, you would imagine that it would be something else, but then, because, you know, in love triangles, they don't always explore what's happening on the back end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I really kind of really liked where it went, and that's kind of what I think the song is saying.
Were you involved in a love triangle at the time that you recorded that?
No, not at all. No, I just liked the concept of it. It's kind of romantic, you know? It's kind of not about anything at the end. It's just about like the power of this love and it being shared and the understanding of these things that happen. Like just talking in a very simple and real way, which is what I really appreciate.
Yeah. But listening to it and not knowing what the words mean, it does have a melancholy sound to it. It sounds sad to me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not the right interpretation?
I think it is. You know, there's a sadness, an inherent sadness in love in general. I think we would all agree, you know. Mm-hmm. But then there's also like a sweetness in it, right? Like this melancholic kind of hope and desire for another love, you know, or for the love or for any relationship to become have more love. So I feel like that's kind of what's happening in the song.
Yeah. So getting back to this idea that you were nominated at the Grammys, you know, here you are talking about ideas from mystical Urdu poetry from many centuries ago, and then you're going to be at the Grammys, which is the most kind of American pop culture phenomenon there is around this time of year, and it just seems like it's a bit of a culture clash. How do you feel about it?
I feel like it's kind of great, you know? I kind of feel like there's all these weird idiosyncrasies in the music industry, right? Like the Grammys being so inherently American, but also just being like the highest accolade in the world for music. You know, it's like clashes with, you know, like those two things really clash. So it's hard to say that it's American because it's also so globally sought after. And I just think that there are millions of people all over the world who listen to pop music, right? But then there are also millions of people all over the world who listen to alternative music, who listen to this music that I'm making, which really comes out of like 20 years of living in New York and 5 years of studying jazz in Boston and being from Pakistan. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't get more New York, diverse, melting pot, utopia, Americana than that, right? It feels really good. I'm saying so much, but you know what I mean? Like, it feels right. And it feels like the Academy is doing a good thing here, where it's realizing that this is also popular, but just from a different lens. And it deserves to be in the running as a Best New Artist. And one of the biggest things is that the American audiences are okay now listening to music that isn't in English, you know, because everywhere else in the world, they've been doing this for a long time very easily, right? This is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a giant breakthrough, to be honest, and good for everyone, right? Like more music to listen to, you know? So yeah, I'm really happy. I'm super stoked. I can't wait to actually be there and hang out.
Well, hopefully you won't have to wait too long. I know the Grammys have been postponed indefinitely, but they will take place sometime this year. I'm quite confident of that.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. I'm really excited too, and I'm so pleased that you were nominated.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's Aruj Aftab. Her new album is called Vulture Prince, which you can check out now. It's out now, and she's nominated for a couple of Grammys this year. Ye jo halka halka suroor hai after a brutal weekend for LA football fans. The Sklar brothers will be here for some predictions. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
It was a tough weekend for LA football with two nail-biting overtime games. The LA Rams were set to coast to a win against San Francisco. That is until the 49ers clawed their way back from 17 points behind and won in overtime. The Rams will still head to the playoffs. The Chargers were not as lucky. Joining us to talk about some football are Randy and Jason Sklar, a.k.a. the Sklar Brothers. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Hi, Madeline.
I am well. All right. Not as well. I think I'm better than the Chargers. What happened to them?
Yeah. Oh, my God. First of all, both games were insane. If you're a football fan and not a LA sports fan, then you were treated to incredible games. The Rams were up by 17. And, you know, the 49ers have what many consider to be, if not the best tight end in the game. He's a very demonstrative gentleman named George Kittle. And a lot of the Rams were chirping in his ear, "You're up, we're up 17. This narrative of the San Francisco 49ers beating the Rams like they have in the last couple of years is over." And George Kittle just said, "A lot of time up on the clock, boys." And then, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo, the quarterback who was much maligned in San Francisco, had a terrible first half. The last 30 minutes of the game in overtime, he brought that team back and they won. And he put San Francisco into the playoffs. Now, the Rams were safe. They're on top of their conference there. And so they're fine and they're in the playoffs. But that's a tough game to lose the way they lost it too. Friends of ours who were Detroit Lions fans who played, you know, were fans for years and years of Matt Stafford in Detroit said that was classic Matt Stafford. Made some great throws. And then when it counted the most, he threw an interception at the end. And they just don't want to see that happening in the playoffs for the Rams as well.
Well, are people pretty disgruntled with him as the quarterback?
I think they think he's great in a lot of ways, but if this behavior in terms of, you know, turning the ball over at key times, is, you know, crops up again, yeah, then they're not going to make it that far.
Jay?
I mean, I'd say there's no question about his talent, but the question is, can he deliver in winning time? And that's what Randy was bringing up. You know, to not be able to win, to not be able to close.
Yeah.
Okay, we're losing Jay. Pick up Randy.
Yeah, we're losing Jason. That's fine. Yeah, that to not be able to win when it counts. I mean, that's what the great quarterbacks, the Tom Brady's, the Aaron Rodgers is of this league. They do that. And, you know, the Chargers have a fantastic quarterback, young quarterback in Justin Herbert, who many people think will be a league MVP when all is said and done. Again, 6'6", the guy can run, he can throw. He brought the Chargers back. And I thought the Chargers had a chance to win that game. So many things happened at the end of that game. It was insane. So at the end of the game, the Chargers and the Raiders are tied. They're in overtime. If they just tie the game, then both the Chargers and the Raiders make it into the playoffs. And Pittsburgh, who was patiently waiting and watching to see who would win, they're out. But in overtime, the coach of the Chargers called a very weird timeout towards the end of overtime as the Raiders were moving down the field. People were asking, why is he calling a timeout? Because time is ticking off the clock and the Raiders may not have enough time to get in field goal range to win the game in overtime. He called a timeout, which was basically a gift to the Raiders to recollect themselves. And Derek Carr, the quarterback of the Raiders, said that actually changed our mindset when they called that timeout and they went for the field goal and they won. The Raiders beat the Chargers, knocked them out, and Pittsburgh made it into the playoffs in a very
weird. So why did he do that? What was his explanation for calling the timeout?
He didn't really, because maybe he thought there's a chance for them to save a little bit of time for his own quarterback to lead the Chargers back down if the defense could make a stand, but the defense didn't make a stand. And so it was a very hard way for the Chargers to lose. But I will say this about the Chargers, coming down as Justin Herbert was bringing that team back into that game. they faced so many fourth down and long conversions. It was amazing. Fourth and 10, which is typically not a down that you would try and go for it. Fourth and one, fourth and two, you could see that. But literally, there were about five or six times when Justin Herbert literally at fourth and long was making plays. And I think there was a fourth and 16 that he threw a touchdown pass to tie the game. It was incredible. So if you are a Chargers fan, you're not making the playoffs this year, and that stinks. But take solace in the fact that you have a franchise generational talent at quarterback that if you just get a few other things right, you will be in the playoffs for many years to come, and you have a guy who could be a league MVP when some of these older, better quarterbacks start to retire.
Okay. Well, so getting back to the Rams, and you're back. So
yes, I am. Yes.
Yay. Thanks. Thank you for coming back. They're going to face the Cardinals at SoFi Stadium in the playoffs. Who wins?
This is a tough game. I mean, the Cardinals, they lost their final season game against the Seahawks, and in a game that they should have won. And so they're coming in without momentum as well. And all year long, you know, certainly at the first part of the year, the Arizona Cardinals, they were the team to beat. They were the best team in the league. And then the last couple of weeks, they don't have the momentum they had earlier in the year. So look, it's going to be a tough game. They are division rivals, which is interesting for a first round of the playoffs. But, you know, I think if the Rams can put it together and can close, then they can beat this team, and they can win this game in this moment based on how the Arizona Cardinals season has been going.
I think the Rams have a better offense too, or excuse me, defense, Madeline.
Defense.
The Arizona Cardinals have the best quarterback talent between Matt Stafford, and his name is Kyler Murray, and the guy almost looks like he's a video game character in how fast his burst of speed is when he runs. So as a runner, you have to watch out. But I do really like the Rams defense. And in the playoffs, what you see, especially in the playoffs and as you head towards the Super Bowl, defense tends to tighten up. And the plays that were there earlier in the year just aren't there. And so my money is on the Rams to actually win this game and move forward.
Hmm. Speaking of SoFi, the Super Bowl is going to be there next month.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that during this pandemic?
I mean, you know, we could be hurtling towards another fanless Super Bowl, but who knows? I mean, that's the thing you kind of watch out for is in all of sports, we're seeing college basketball games being canceled. This is very reminiscent of 2020. And, you know, we thought we kind of had control of this thing as you have spoken about deeply on this show.
Yeah.
But in the world of sports, it's just hard to gather lots of people to watch things. And as, you know, the Omicron is running rampant through that variant's running rampant through the teams. They can't even field enough guys to play. You just hope that significant guys aren't taken out. And then you have some players that themselves are not getting vaccinated. And in the tennis world, I know we're not going to get deep into this, but Novak Djokovic, for many, are the greatest of all time. He's embroiled in a whole legal battle in Australia to get in, even though he's not vaccinated and he had COVID, to get in and play in the Australian Open. And, you know, it's a stalemate there. I don't know if he's going to get in and be able to play in that Grand Slam tournament. So,
all right, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to switch gears because I know you knew actor and comedian Bob Saget. He died over the weekend yesterday, became a household name in the 80s as Danny Tanner in the sitcom Full House. Here's a clip.
I'm Danny Tanner. Rebecca Donaldson is on assignment today, so filling in for her is a man who needs no introduction because he's not here.
And then he also, of course, hosted America's Funniest Home Videos. He was also a stand-up comedian. And you knew him, at least professionally. Just your reactions.
I mean, deep sadness because he was one of those guys. And if you go on to social media, you'll see all the comedians that you know and love, the best of the best comedians paying tribute to this guy as a legend. And that's what he was. I mean, Jay and I remember first watching him on the Rodney Dangerfield Young Comedian Special when we were kids, when we were just fans of comedy as, you know, middle school kids. And he was so quick and so fast. It's funny that the two biggest things he was known for, America's Funniest Home Videos and Full House and Fuller House, those things were very sort of milquetoast compared
tame dad, sort of dad humor. But I think in reaction to that, he kind of broke out in the film The Aristocrats by telling a very filthy version of that joke. And then as people got to see him on the road, he kind of leaned into a very sort of blue version of comedy and dark. And he wasn't afraid to go there. And I think it was almost a reaction to how the most popular things that he was in, the things he was most well known for, were so tame and so middle of the road.
But he was so sweet and always made us laugh when we were around him, always. I remember being up in the belly room of the Comedy Store, and this is maybe three years ago, and we were judging the roast battle that was going on there, and he kind of slid in and was like almost like a celebrity judge and judged a few things with us, and we made a joke that just made him laugh, which was so great because he always gave it up for people in the best possible ways. And we just leaned into him and we told him, see, twins can be funny. And he laughed even harder and he made us feel good about it. And that's what we'll remember, the guy who made other people feel good.
Jason and Randy Sklar, you make us feel good. Thank you. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.